It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, glimpses of urban foxes and coyotes in the city are happening routinely these days. We'll hear about a new project out to answer some key questions about urban wildlife.
First, two federal court decisions in the past couple of days could affect Wisconsin's voters and elections.
Yesterday, a federal judge dismissed parts of a challenge to the state's voter ID law, but left room for clarification on what types of identification could be accepted.
And in a separate case on Thursday, a panel of federal judges allowed a lawsuit about the state's redistricting plan to continue.
For more on these decisions and how it will affect future elections in the state, we're joined by Rick Hazen. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He also runs the Election Law blog. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the voter ID decision, Rick. What did the judge decide regarding Wisconsin's voter ID law?
Well, the first thing the judge did was reject a Voting Rights Act challenge to the law as a whole, and the plaintiffs expected that. The point of this was just to preserve it for a potential future appeal to the Supreme Court. The Seventh Circuit, in an earlier case last year, you may remember, rejected a similar kind of challenge. And so that's out. But what the judge did say was that it's possible to bring a claim about some of the specifics of the law, particularly not accepting technical college IDs, not accepting expired IDs or out-of-state IDs. And so that's going to go forward. He also left open the possibility of challenges based on the idea that this was a law that was intended to discriminate against Democrats and fence Democrats out of the political process. And that's not a theory that the courts had looked at the last time that this law was challenged.
Well, let's go back to those types of IDs voters can use. What reasoning was the state using, or what were they arguing to say that certain types of IDs were not valid for voting? And which ones did they specifically single out?
Well, the way that voter ID laws work is that they'll typically have a list of the types of IDs that are acceptable. So in some states, you might be able to bring your utility bill. In other states, you might have to bring something that is a current photo ID that has an expiration date. This was turns out to be a big problem with student IDs, which generally don't have expiration dates. And in Wisconsin, I think the colleges added expiration dates to get around that problem. And so the claim is that that the plaintiffs are bringing is that the IDs that are being rejected are just as valid in terms of verifying someone's identity as the ones that are accepted, and it's therefore a violation of equal protection to deny those voters the chance to be able to vote with these particular forms of ID.
So the court did say that they were leaving that for further consideration. Did they give any opinion about whether it was a valid restriction on what types of IDs could be used?
No, this was at a very early stage of the case. This is just going to let it go forward on the basis of evidence. The one piece that is really interesting about the judge's ruling is that the judge said, look, I'm a district court judge. I'm bound by what the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit said in the last case. But I just want to be on the record as saying that the whole idea that voter ID laws promote public confidence is not something that I think is actually true. And so the judge really went out of his way to express skepticism about what the courts had held in the last round of briefing and decision in this case.
So you also said that another challenge that was left open is the claim that this law discriminates against Democratic voters. What specifically is the argument there?
Well, in Wisconsin, as in I think all the states where these new strict voter ID laws have been passed, they pass on party lines. And it's pretty much understood that to the extent these laws have any effect on turnout, they are likely to affect people who are poor, who are minority voters, who are moving voters, younger voters, all groups that tend to vote Democratic. And Democrats have argued that this law is actually intended to make it harder for those likely to vote Democratic to vote. And even Judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit, who had rejected that argument back in 2007 when there was a challenge to Indiana's law, recently suggested in a dissenting opinion in the last round of the Wisconsin voter ID case that that is actually the reason that these laws are being passed. And so that's going to get a fuller airing in this new case.
So generally when bringing a court case, the plaintiffs have to have some kind of standing and be affected, directly affected in the situation. Who is it exactly that are the plaintiffs in this case?
Well, these are plaintiffs that are, some are Democrats, some are people who have the wrong kinds of IDs. And so if you are, for example, have only an identification that is expired, then you could potentially be in the plaintiff's class to bring this kind of suit.
And are there any larger organizations that are backing these claims by the plaintiffs?
Well, you'll have to talk to someone who's more familiar with the kind of the politics of what's behind all of this than I am from my perch out here in California.
We're talking with Rick Hazen. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He also runs the Election Law blog. And, Rick, the Wisconsin Elections Board has said it will be tough to implement voter ID requirements in time for 2016's elections. Could this law make things tougher for the organization to implement?
Well, you know, the GAB that's been running elections has now been put out of business, and
right.
There's a transition to a new board. It would not surprise me to see a new lawsuit or maybe an add-on to this lawsuit arguing that even if voter ID laws generally are constitutional and don't violate the Voting Rights Act, if the state can't show it can actually get IDs into the hands of everyone that wants them in time and to implement the law fairly, that maybe the law needs to be put on hold. This claim was actually made successfully in a challenge to Pennsylvania's voter ID law, where there the Department of Transportation really couldn't process all the people who want to get IDs. The law was put on hold, and eventually the government gave up trying to enforce this voter ID law, and they don't have that new law in effect right now.
So is it possible, do you think, that that kind of delay or that putting it on hold could happen in Wisconsin?
It certainly is possible that it could be put on hold. I don't think that putting it on hold would mean that it wouldn't be implemented in future elections, but mm-hmm. There could be a fight over its use in the 2016 elections, and that would really depend upon what the evidence shows about how many people who want to get these state-issued IDs would not be able to get them in time in order to be able to vote in the upcoming elections.
Let's move on to the other federal decision yesterday. A panel of judges has allowed a lawsuit into Wisconsin's redistricting plan to continue. What was the reasoning for allowing that case to proceed?
Well, this is a really complicated area of law. So when the claim is that when you draw district lines for the General Assembly in that case, but it could also be for congressional districts or for other districting, that if you draw the lines and you do so to help one party and hurt another party, perhaps that violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. This is a claim called a partisan gerrymandering claim. And the state of these claims are very odd right now. There are four justices on the court who reject on the Supreme Court, who reject all such arguments and say these cases are non-justiciable, they can't be heard in court. There are four justices on the court who think that these are good claims and court should start policing when Republicans try to make it hard for Democrats to elect people they want or Democrats to do this to Republicans. And then there's Justice Kennedy in the middle. He's the swing justice on the court and on this issue. And what he says is, I haven't found a standard that lets me decide when it's acceptable to take party information into account in drawing district lines and when it's unconstitutional. I've rejected all the standards that have come before me so far, but keep trying to come up with a new standard. And so what this Wisconsin case is trying to come up with a new standard to argue, here's how you can know when taking party into account in drawing district lines is too much and crosses the line into unconstitutionality. What the three judges said in the opinion yesterday was, there's enough of a theory of a new way of trying to do this that we're going to let the parties gather evidence and make their case before the court.
Very briefly, in the last minute or so that we have, just this afternoon, three district attorneys have moved to try to bring the state's John Doe investigation before the Supreme Court. What are the chances that the court would take that case?
Well, there are two issues there. One is about whether the Wisconsin Supreme Court has correctly interpreted the campaign finance laws. I think that one maybe does not have a good chance. But the other is that the justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court should have recused themselves because they themselves were beneficiaries of some of the same groups that were before them in their own reelection campaigns. And so the argument is it violates due process for them not to have recused themselves from deciding the case. The court could be interested in that. Again, it may depend on what Justice Kennedy thinks.
And so what would the next step be in that?
Well, the next place to go is the Supreme Court, and there would a decision would have to be made to file what's called a cert petition. That would go to the Supreme Court. It's completely discretionary as to whether or not the court would decide to take that case if the court is asked to do so.
And that would probably, if they do decide to take it, that probably wouldn't be for at least another year down the road?
Well, it takes a few months to get this going, and there's responses, and so I think it's possible that the court could decide by the end of its term in June to hear the case, and it would probably hear it next year if it agreed to hear the case.
And as you said, there were some that that would vote one way or the other. Is there any prediction on how it might go?
Well, we know that Justice Kennedy cares very much about judges not appearing to be biased in cases. Even Chief Justice Roberts in a recent case suggested that. So there might be some interest on the court in this case. It really depends upon whether they think what's going on in before the Wisconsin Supreme Court with their elected justices is really egregious compared to what usually goes on when judges have to take campaign contributions to run for office.
Rick, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Rick Hazen is the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He also runs the Election Law blog.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, you're probably getting a lot of invitations to holiday parties, but what dish should you bring? Food Friday regular Lori Skelton will share her favorite holiday side dishes.
First, a project out of UW-Madison is out to answer some questions about the foxes and coyotes that make their homes in urban areas.
The Urban Canid Project humanely traps foxes and coyotes, tags them, collects samples, and uses their data to figure out how foxes and coyotes in urban places get along, where they go, and what they eat.
David Drake is leading one of the Urban Canid research teams. He's an associate professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, how did the Urban Canid Project get started?
It is kind of a long story, but it got started essentially because people were seeing coyotes with some regular frequency out at Picnic Point as they were walking their pets and just recreating out at Picnic Point. And the Lakeshore Nature Preserve contacted me a couple of years ago just to see what was going on with the coyotes out there. And so we put out a couple of game cameras and then evolved to doing a pilot project where we caught a couple of coyotes and a fox here on the University of Wisconsin campus as a, again, a pilot project. But I had an undergraduate student doing a independent research project on that. And then it was just such an interesting project that I was able to find some funding and expand it to a graduate student project, which we are currently in that phase right now.
Well, what kinds of questions is the Urban Canid Project trying to answer?
Yep. So we've got our first phase, which we're kind of in now. We've got three primary things we're looking at. And one, the first is primarily the most academic of them. And that is to see how fox and coyote are sharing space in an urbanized environment. So if you go out into the country, typically if a fox is caught by a coyote, that coyote will kill the fox because it sees it as a competitor.
And they're bigger coyotes,
yep,
right?
Coyotes can be at least twice as big as a fox, sometimes three times as big, depending on the fox and coyote size. So the fox is always a prey item to a coyote, primarily to limit competition. And we do not think that we're seeing as much predator-prey dynamics here in the city of Madison. And one of our hypotheses is that there's so many resources here, primarily for food, that the animals can share the resource. They don't necessarily have to compete for the resource. And so my graduate student is looking at spatial overlap, both in space and time, between fox and coyote to see if they're actually, if that predator-prey dynamic is actually relaxing or breaking down in an urbanized environment. So that's one thing we're looking at. Every animal we trap, we draw blood on it, and we swab its nasal and rectal passage, and we collect feces. So we conduct a health screen on animals, and we're trying to assess how healthy these animals are from a disease standpoint. But we're also interested in, as these animals are moving across the landscape, what's the potential for disease transmission to other species, primarily domestic dogs, but it also could be humans as well. There could be some zoonotic disease risk there. And then the third part of it is to we're trying to our best to be as proactive as we can be to limit conflict between mostly coyote, but to some extent red fox, but mostly coyote and humans and coyote and domestic dogs. And recently there have been some coyote attacks on domestic pets in the east side of Madison. And so we are trying to understand how these animals move through the urban landscape, when their peak activity patterns are and things like that, so that we can head off these conflicts before they really get started.
Right, and this is something that made the papers in Madison, in the Madison area, these dog and coyote conflicts. And I was actually up in Door County and I heard people talking about it. in an alarming, you know, they were kind of alarmed about this, saying you can't let our dog out anymore. How nervous do people need to be about this? Set this in some perspective for us.
Yeah, I don't think they need to be, really nervous about it. But if there are coyotes around and you know they're where you live and you have your pet, especially a small pet, you know, maybe 20 pounds or smaller, you probably should be vigilant and not let that pet outside at night, primarily at night by itself. And maybe you want to be with it in the backyard, even if your yard's fenced. And if you're walking your dog, you probably need to keep the dog in leash and things like that, especially if there are coyotes around that have shown some aggressive tendencies. But, you know, coyotes are carnivores and they're predators and they're acting as they should. They just don't differentiate between Fido and a rabbit necessarily. They see it as either something to eat or another dog is in their territory and they want to get that dog out of that territory.
Well, I was assuming, you know, well, in natural areas, a coyote or a fox, they would hunt for their food. But in urban areas, are they also scavengers as well as hunters?
Yeah, both these animals are what we call generalist species. So both the coyote and red fox. And generalist means that they can range across a wide variety of habitats, but they also can eat a wide variety of food sources. And so even though we classify coyote and fox as carnivores, they really are omnivores. And they're very adaptive and they're very opportunistic. So if something crosses their path and it looks delicious to them, they're probably going to try to eat it. But surprisingly, we are just starting to do some diet studies very preliminarily here. But there's the longest running urban coyote project in the world is just south of us in Chicago, and they've looked at some diet studies down there pretty extensively. And what's interesting about it is even though coyotes are living in the third largest metropolitan area in the United States, that they're still maintaining a relatively native and natural diet. So they're still eating what you would expect them to eat out in the country or out in the wild parts. And certainly they will take advantage of situations where maybe trash is available to them to eat, or they could eat out of the compost pile in your backyard or something like that. But they still are eating a majority of food that you'd find them eating in the country.
So if people want to get involved and help out with this effort, how do you want them to reach out to you?
Yeah, so we've got a number of ways. First off, we would encourage you to follow us on our Facebook page, and we put almost daily updates up, especially now we're in the middle of our trapping season. Or not in the middle, but we're getting started trapping again for this year. And so as we catch animals and we learn things about the animals, we put updates on our Facebook page. And that's a way that you can monitor our progress. So that's one way to stay involved. And our Facebook page, you don't have to be a Facebook user or have a Facebook account. It's an open account. And if you Google UW Urban Canid, which is C as in Charlie, A-N-I-D as in Delta, Project, UW Urban Canid Project, you'll find us. We also invite the public to come out trapping with us and checking traps. And so we've had probably over 200 members of the public come out as we go on our daily trap checks. And if the public is lucky enough to be with us when we catch an animal, we usually will put them to work and either data log for us or monitor the animal's health as we are working the animal up and things like that. So that's another way to get involved. And on our website, which is uwurbancanidproject.weebly.com, we have a part of our website where you can report a sighting on an iNaturalist page that we've created. And we are asking the public, anytime you see an animal that's either marked with a radio collar or ear tags or not marked, that we would encourage you to go to our iNaturalist page and please report that sighting, because it helps us to understand where these animals are and where they're moving and things of that nature.
Well, I got to say, it seems like there are a lot of coyotes and foxes in the area lately here, at least in the Madison area. I know I've seen foxes trotting through churchyards and near cemeteries. Is there a boom in the sort of wildlife going on, or is it just that all of a sudden everybody's aware of them?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Our sense is, just from our early data collection, is that there's probably more coyotes in the city of Madison than there are fox. And coyotes probably have colonized or moved into the Madison years before the fox have, and the fox have probably been a more recent colonizer. And so we don't think, based on some of our data, we don't think there are as many fox here as we initially thought, because the fox seem to be much more wide-ranging. So over maybe a week time, those fox will move maybe six, seven miles, something like that. And if they were moving that great a distance and there were a lot of fox here, they would be crossing other foxes' territories, which they wouldn't be allowed to do by the owner of that territory. So we don't think there's as many fox here, because these foxes are much more wide-ranging in their movement patterns than are the coyotes. But I think partly it's we're probably more aware that the animals are here because we're trying to make the public more aware of it. There's probably more sightings because the animals are here and they're reproducing and things like that, and there is space available for more animals to come in. So it's probably a little bit of a combination of both.
So exciting times for lovers of foxes and coyotes in Madison.
Yeah.
And I guess other cities. You're seeing this in other cities, and you mentioned Chicago. How about, Milwaukee and other urban areas in the state?
Yep. So Milwaukee has got, again, these animals are general species. And so they are in just about every metropolitan and urban area across the United States and into Canada as well. And so it would not be unexpected to see fox or coyote in Milwaukee or Chicago or Phoenix or, Los Angeles, New York, wherever you want to think about. And certainly over in Milwaukee, we know coyotes are present over there because they've had some of these same unfortunate pet attacks as we've been experiencing here on the east side of Madison. And so you just have to be aware of them. And I think it's neat to have these animals. I would personally much rather have these animals here in the city with us than not have them, as I think it adds to our quality of life. And whether you love or hate a coyote, for example, or a red fox, that it still excites people to see it. And it's kind of neat that we still have that connection to nature.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us on.
David Drake is an associate professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. He leads one of the urban canid research teams studying the lives of urban coyotes and urban foxes.
What does the fox say?
Judith Sears Poisson in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's peak holiday party season, and one dilemma you might have about these parties is what to bring.
Well, don't worry. We put Food Friday regular Lori Skelton on the case. We asked her to experiment with side dishes for holiday parties for this edition of Food Friday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to side dish for potluck parties at this time of year, and what do you typically bring to holiday parties to share with your friends? And what if you don't know what allergies people might have to food or what other dishes will be at the party? What do you do then? You can call now with your go-to recipes at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton joins us now. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So what would you say makes a good, solid holiday party side dish?
I like to think of easy, because who wants extra work at this time of the year? Make ahead, preferably tasty at room temperature.
Yes, I agree.
But if you are going to bring something that should be served hot, I would suggest you think of something that you can make in a crock pot and then bring the crock pot with you. And when you bring a crock pot to a gathering, go ahead and err on the side of caution. Bring along a power strip as well. Because invariably what happens, I mean, you may not know the layout of the kitchen or the buffet table if you are always going to need an extra outlet or two. So bring along your power strip as well. So that's a good thing to start with. Crock pot is always a great idea at a holiday party. But from there on, this is one where I didn't just rely on my own instincts. I asked everybody I knew for suggestions. And we even put a suggestion up on the Central Time Facebook page. And I did take Missy Michelle's suggestion for making Persian rice. I brought that in earlier today. I don't know if I would recommend this for taking to somebody's house, but if you're hosting the gathering and you want a really amazing rice dish, Persian rice takes a lot of different steps, but I think it's really, really worth it. This is the kind of rice that is boiled first to get it soft but not mushy, and then you mix some of it with yogurt and mound it in your dish that's going to steam it so that the bottom gets crispy. Mm-hmm. It's called tadig, and it's this part of the rice dish that is most prized around a Persian table. So you've got a little bit of crispy rice and a lot of soft, well-flavored rice. I was really, really impressed. So, Missy Michelle, thank you for that suggestion.
And you can dress that one up. You can elaborate on it, right? You can put in nuts and cranberries, dried fruit, lots of things.
Absolutely. I made the batch today with a great deal of saffron, and that's going to give it a bitter edge. And a lot of people said, I love the taste, but I wouldn't mind some sweetness. How about throwing in some golden raisins? Mm-hmm. How about throwing in some almonds? If you don't know the saffron preferences of your group, however, do pull back, because I had several people tell me this was so bitter it tasted like a cleaning product.
You
not
like
a good
saffron.
Thing. Not yeah. a good thing.
Not a fan of. I happen to love that bitterness, but it's not a favorite of everyone. So that's one you may want to keep in mind. The easiest way to do what you'd call a jeweled rice would just be to make up some wonderful rice. Basmati is always a great touch. And then mix in a little bit of broth and butter, and then add your dried fruits, your nuts. That doesn't take as many steps. It's just as delicious and probably a little bit prettier, depending on what you throw in.
And my favorite add-on into a rice dish like that is pomegranate seeds.
Because
they're beautiful. They give that extra little burst of flavor. And you know, I'm so happy that a friend taught me how to get the seeds out of a pomegranate without staining myself and half of the kitchen.
How do you do it?
I do it in a bowl of water.
Okay.
So I rip it apart in water. You have the pith and the membranes that still stay with the skin, and all the seeds float to the top.
Yes.
So you just scoop
handy.
Them right out.
I know I've seen several people suggest cut the thing in half and then whack it with a wooden spoon. I tried that, and my ceiling looked like Jackson Pollock in blood. It was just not pretty.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, on that image, we're going to move on to another salad. Yeah, you experimented with a chop and toss salad. What was that?
Jennifer Hadley at Wisconsin Public Television suggested this. It's a broccoli salad with dried cherries. And I thought, really? Broccoli and cherries? And I tried it. I loved it. Brought it in for the pledge drive last week, and it was gone instantly. We've got this on the Central Time Facebook page, and Jen's suggestion to me was, here's what I do, but you can also do. Mm-hmm. So I've put as many possible options with that recipe as you can come up with. You blanch your broccoli briefly. Cut it into tiny florets so it's bite-sized. Mm-hmm. Blanch it briefly, and then mix it with minced red onion, minced yellow pepper. I want the yellow pepper for that great color contrast. Besides, it looks like something for the Packers with the green and the yellow. And then dried cherries. You could use craisins, you could use raisins if you like, but I thought the cherries and the broccoli were amazing together. Then she had a sweeter balsamic vinaigrette. If you want to make this straight vegan, you can use sugar with your balsamic and your oil. I actually made mine with honey. Mm. And bumped it up a little bit. I thought it was amazing.
We're talking with Lori Skelton right now, one of our in-house foodies here at Wisconsin Public Radio, getting ideas for what to bring to that potluck holiday gathering, especially when you have no idea what everybody else is bringing. You don't know allergies. What are some of your greatest hits? And Lori's sharing some of hers right now. And Lori, apples, you said, are your friend at gatherings like this. Why so?
Because they can be so versatile. One person here at Wisconsin Public Radio said that they make an apple and sweet potato casserole. Checking the internet, I find that apples are a great way to lighten a lot of vegetable casseroles. To certainly add that sweetness you'll always find in an apple, somebody suggested cook parsnips and apples together in gingered broth, whether you want chicken or vegetable, and then puree them. And it makes a great alternative to mashed potatoes.
What would gingered broth be?
Ginger in your broth.
So you just saute it in a little bit and then add more
and then,
broth?
Exactly. I like fresh ginger for this, but powdered ginger mixed in with your broth would be just as good. Believe it or not, Italians make an apple risotto, which would be a great dish to pass. You can either make that, again, with broth, or some people snark it up with Worcestershire sauce. Mm. And that would be a great accompaniment to just about anything on the table. One nice thing to keep in mind is that if you're using apples, if you want something that's going to hold its shape, easy to find, Granny Smith all the way. But if you're looking for something that's going to cook down into a sauce-like consistency, there are four apples, Fuji, Gala, Cortland, and Empire. Not only do they cook down well, these apples don't brown very quickly. So if you're going to make some sort of cold salad with fresh apples in, keep those four varieties in mind, and your dish will look great all through the buffet.
Let's go to the phones, and Susie in New Berlin has an idea for us. Hi, Susie.
Hello. You were talking before about hot dishes in crock pots, and this one would work very well for it. You can make it way ahead of time. In fact, it tastes better the second day. It's one of those. It's sauerkraut and noodles. It's kind of a bastardization of a dish that was always served on at the Friday fish fries at one of the Catholic churches in Cudahy. But it's basically a great big yellow onion sautéed in the fat from a pound of bacon that you've just cut up in small pieces and then sautéed. And then you put in about a pound of sliced mushrooms, and then a little brown sugar and caraway seeds if you like, and then a bag of cooked noodles and a big can of sauerkraut, or a big bottle. I actually like the jarred stuff better, and or fresh. And then you just let it cook, and a little bit of salt, maybe a little bit of pepper, and you just let it cook. And it kind of all melts together, and, oh, it's really, really good.
Wow. Now, you're talking egg noodles, correct?
Egg noodles, yeah.
Okay,
sorry.
Great.
Or, the German noodles. I can't think of the name of them.
Kluski?
I
know, that's Polish.
Kluski noodles is actually what I was thinking of.
Okay.
And those are the best ones with it, I think. But
Those are going to be a little bit thinner, right?
Kluski noodles are thick, and they're kind of like the noodles that are in Campbell's chicken noodle soup. They're thick, but not wide.
That's it. Great.
And how does that go over when you take it to a party?
Well, most of the time it goes over extremely well. I've mostly served it in the Milwaukee area, but I served it in Minneapolis, and it goes over really well there. I had it at a group party. It was a dancing party. We were going to be doing folk dancing, and had a big potluck before that in the Madison area, and everybody loved it. A lot of times people are a little afraid to try it at first. Ooh, sauerkraut, but once actually it mellows out quite a bit, especially because of the brown sugar and bacon and all of that, and it's just wonderful, I think.
Well, thanks so much for that idea, Susie. I have to tell you, you had me at the browning the onions in the fat from a pound of bacon, and the sauerkraut was just gravy on top of that. So
now, and of course, if you are concerned, are there any vegetarians, you can always use butter. Claudine in Neosho gave me the suggestion of make a dish with cabbage, because cabbage is one of the few foods where almost no one has a problem with. Maybe it might make you burp, but there's not really an allergic reaction. So I, of course, immediately thought of my grandmother's rotkohl, red cabbage, sweet and sour with a little vinegar, little apples, sometimes bacon, sometimes brown sugar. There are as many ways to make rotkohl as there are German grandmas in Wisconsin. So that's another great way to bring cabbage to a party.
Well, we're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton now about holiday side dishes. And we want to know, what do you bring to potluck parties? What's your go-to side dish? What's the best side dish you've ever had at a party? Call in with your ideas and recipes now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about holiday potluck greatest hits.
What do you usually bring to potluck parties? What if you don't know what other dishes will be there? What's your go-to party contribution? Call in now and share at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go back to our callers now. We've got Fred on the line in Madison. Fred, hi.
Hey, I missed the side dish portion, but usually I bring a rabbit to potlucks, make it a day ahead of time in the pressure cooker, and then brown it again in the frying pan with some onions and garlic, and then use chicken casserole recipes. It is always a big hit, and when people ask for the recipe and I give it to them, they're always pleasantly surprised. Side dishes, I usually use picnic greens, always made with bacon and the beans soaked in the pan drippings from making the bacon.
So what was this item again, Fred, this last one?
Picnic style beans.
Picnic beans, okay, gotcha.
Several different kinds of beans and some bacon, maybe some ground venison fried in the bacon fat, and brown sugar and seasonings.
All right, Fred, thank you. Well, Lori, we've got some beans and some rabbit there. What do you think?
Well, I never say no to rabbit, although I would have to know my guests really, really well before I'd spring that on them. I know not everyone's a fan of eating a bunny, even though I am.
I am too, so Fred, you're always welcome at my potlucks.
And I had a pet rabbit, so I'm okay. With the other camp that thinks they're cute and fuzzy.
And beans are certainly a marvelous option, especially if you can figure out a way to do picnic beans for a vegetarian crowd. There you've got your protein. I'm not quite sure that you can substitute butter the way you do bacon for picnic mm-hmm. beans. I'll have to work on that. Mm-hmm. But good ideas.
So, Lori, you have a savory bread pudding recipe that you made in preparation for this segment. What goes into it?
I was a little hesitant to include this because I know some people are having gluten issues. But if you can find a really good gluten-free bread, you're home free. This was another piece of deliciousness I brought in for the pledge drive. Somebody suggested a bread pudding with caramelized onions and oil-cured olives. So I started with a recipe that Mark Bittman had on the New York Times website for a savory bread pudding that had mushrooms in it, and substituted the olives in for the mushrooms. His includes Parmesan and Swiss cheese and milk, but no eggs in the custard. What you do is you butter a 3-quart baking dish, put your bread in, put the milk and the cheese on top of that, and then weigh it down with a plate so that the bread soaks up everything. Then you mix in your caramelized onions and your olives and bake for about 35 minutes. So it's not a heavy, eggy custard the way you'd normally have with a dessert bread pudding, but there's still enough dairy in there that the bread soaks it up. It was delicious, more so than I expected. Again,
that was yummy. And it wasn't a negative comment. The only thing that some people were surprised that this was savory. They were going, something, a sweet bread pudding. Whoa, no. Kalamata olives and Swiss cheese. Yep. But once that, it was delicious.
And there you can also play around. I used a mild Emmental cheese. If you want something a little bit more hefty, maybe use a Jarlsberg or something. What you want is a semi-soft cheese to be grated. You don't want a really sharp cheddar.
And what about the bread? Do you want something that's got some heft to it, or do you want something that's going to immediately be nice and soft?
I'd say go for the medium here. You don't want bread that you have to hew with an axe. Mm-hmm. But I'd get a decent loaf of, the bread you'd use for a sub sandwich.
Okay.
And then let that sit for a day and then tear it up into bite-sized pieces and throw it in.
Nice. Well, and I should point out, Lori, that the recipe for that chop and toss salad is up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right.
And I suppose people can Google for the Mark Bittman one, Mark Bittman bread pudding.
Yes, you can. Start with the New York Times and then just get creative with whatever you want to throw in and make it savory.
Nice. So let's go back to our callers now. Another one here from Anne in Delafield. Anne, hi.
Hi. Let me take you off the speakerphone.
Great. So what is your go-to potluck recipe?
So this is a cheater's recipe, and I don't usually do that. But one day, I'm a realtor, and I had to show houses late into the afternoon and go to a Christmas party, and I was exhausted. And I don't know if I can use the store's name, but I went to Costco, and they have these little pans, or they're not so little, but a pan of pre-made macaroni and cheese, which I had my eye on, but that seemed too bland. And then I passed an aisle that had dips, and there was an artichoke jalapeno cream, cream cheese.
Wow.
Dip. Yep. And I saw a light went on. I took it home. I added some additional grated cheddar cheese and a bit of milk, so it all mixed together. And it makes a 9 by, like, 13 pan of this mac and cheese. Then I put breadcrumbs, you know, buttered breadcrumbs on the top and baked it. And people fought over it. And for the past 3 years in a row, they all call me and say, are you bringing the mac and cheese?
Wow.
That's really great.
They think I made it from scratch.
And there was some effort and ingenuity that went into that. I applaud you for that. That sounds great. And thank you for that. So a cheater one, Lori. Nothing wrong with that.
No. The holidays certainly call out ingenuity in a lot of people. And that's a really, you know, you didn't just show up with somebody else's. You took it home, you made it your own, and then you brought it to the party. That's perfectly fine in my book. So what do you guys bring?
Well, actually, that last caller's story reminded me, I love cooking, and I like trying new things, and I'm always... It's always asked of me rather insistently that I bring the same thing for like family holidays and parties. And it is kind of a cheater recipe. It's a corn casserole, and it has 6 ingredients. It's 1 egg, 1 cup of sour cream, 1 stick of butter, you can do half of that and even it out with canola if you're feeling virtuous. a can of cream corn, a can of kernel corn, and a box of Jiffy corn bread mix. And you mix it all together. Let it kind of ferment a little bit in the bowl and then put it in a 9 by 13 and bake it for an hour at 350. And it is delicious. And one of the best things about it is you can reheat it about 20 times and it never dries out.
Wow. Yeah. My mom has made that. We've never gotten to the reheat stage. It's gone instantly. Yeah.
I have an artichoke dip that I like to make, and it's actually a Land O'Lakes recipe. So this is not very highbrow here, but it's so delicious. It has artichoke hearts and sun-dried tomatoes. This is where it gets a little kicky. And some feta cheese and Swiss cheese.
Okay.
And it's super yummy. It bakes and it's bubbly. I love artichokes, though. As do you, Lori, as we know.
Well,
previous food Fridays.
I was going to say, when I go to my family's Christmas party next week, I'm taking the artichoke dip that I came up with earlier this year for a Food Friday segment.
Excellent.
Several family members were like, how come we don't get to taste this? So I'm heading down to Delavan with the artichokes, folks.
Good
Never
choice.
Fear.
Well, Lori, thanks, as always, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. You can check out the Chop and Toss Salad recipe, which is up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yesterday on the show, we talked to movie critic Mike Mayo about his favorite holiday movies, and we also got a lot of votes from you.
It's always so much fun to hear what you're thinking about, so here are some of what you had to say on Facebook. Diane said, I always watch White Christmas while wrapping Christmas presents.
And Ben said, my favorite movie to watch every Christmas is While You Were Sleeping. Yes, it isn't a movie most people think of with Christmas. I love it because it is all about having loved ones and a family to be with during the holidays. Thanks a lot for that, Ben, and now I'm going to rewatch that one, too. That's a great one.
Sarah said we have 2 Christmas favorites. Elf is a favorite movie. In fact, we named our daughter Jovi for the movie Elf. We also really enjoy Mystery Science Theater 3000 Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Dustin agreed with that vote for Elf, and Rebecca gave a shout out to Gremlins.
And we leave you with a movie that nobody mentioned, but always comes up a winner anyway.
Actually, Lucy, my trouble is Christmas. I just don't understand it. Instead of feeling happy, I feel sort of let down.
You need involvement. You need to get involved in some real Christmas project. How would you like to be the director of our Christmas play?
A wonderful movie. Whatever you pick, we hope you enjoy the holiday movie season.